From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as 1996 comes to a close, we take one last look back on the year in film and pop music. Film critic John Powers will run down his 10 best list and look at the state of the film industry. And pop music critic Ken Tucker will play us some of the records that made it onto his 10 best list. It's our annual 10 Best Show coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're taking a day off from our Words and Music series so we can do our annual 10 Best Show and look back at the year in film and pop music. Tomorrow we'll conclude our Words and Music series with a tribute to Rodgers and Hart, sung by Dawn Upshaw. Our film critic, John Powers, is going to review the year in film and share some of his thoughts on the state of the film industry. John is the film critic for Vogue. 1996 was the first year that he reviewed films for Fresh Air. A little later, we'll talk about some of the films that most influenced him over the years. John, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Why don't we start with your top 10 list? Is there any order in particular you're going to read these in?
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you the 10 in alphabetical order, but leaving my favorite film for last. And I'll just go through them now. Big Night, the film by Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott. Breaking the Waves. The Claude Chabrol film, La Cérémonie. The English Patient, which I think many people have seen. The new film by Albert Brooks, Mother. Jane Campion's film, The Portrait of a Lady, which I think is kind of a controversial choice. Mike Leigh's Secrets and Lies. A little French film called A Single Girl that has played in a few places so far and will be spreading throughout the country later. The controversial film Trainspotting. And my favorite film is a Hong Kong film, of all things, called Chungking Express, which is, I think, easily the most adventurous and fun film of the year and probably should have been a huge hit but wasn't.
Now, I confess I didn't see your top film of the year. It played kind of briefly here. What do you like about it?
I love the fact that it's maybe the one film that seems to be capturing 90s consciousness. It's a love story set in Hong Kong, and it's sort of a portrait of a section of Hong Kong where lovers sort of meet and yearn for one another. And the whole thing is shot in a style that's very fast, very poetic, and very lyrical. And it simultaneously catches people's feelings of sort of living in a city where they're surrounded by people all the time, yet they can never quite connect. So it seems to me something that captures a spirit of an age in the way that maybe the early French films of the French New Wave in the 1960s captured Paris. Chungking Express captures Hong Kong and an entire young approach to city life.
This might be the right occasion to confess in public that I was really disappointed in The English Patient. It struck me as a kind of high-minded romance, a high-minded bodice ripper.
Yes. Well, actually, the thing is, I like the sweep of the film, and I like the romance. What I think is funny about it is that people take it too seriously as a serious film. What it basically is a romance. It's a dime novel done with a kind of pleasant style where I happen to like the central romance. I'm drawn to the Ralph Fiennes and Kristin Scott Thomas characters. And perhaps this is because I've always been a sucker for Kristin Scott Thomas, and I praise her excessively at every opportunity. But I think that's the part of the film that's extremely good, and I like it for that. I guess I like the sweep and ambition, and probably I put it on the list maybe to punish Hollywood a little bit, because this is the kind of film that they should be making, and that they no longer seem to make.
Now, I'll also confess I didn't read the novel, The English Patient. Did you read the novel, and do you think that that's also a dime romance?
No, I suspect that from my attempts to read The English Patient, that it's an over-arty novel. I found it in many ways almost unreadable because it was so beautifully written. I think that it's one of those books where it's so precisely done and so artfully done that I felt slightly kept out of it. so that I was admiring it but not really enjoying it. I think that when Anthony Minghella adapted it for the screen, he sort of expanded what's probably the trashiest part of the novel, which is the love story. And that's the part that I think almost everybody likes.
You know, just about every movie on your top 10 list is a personal film or a literary adaptation. There aren't any big studio American films on that list.
Well, there weren't really very many good big studio American films. I mean, I enjoyed Jerry Maguire. I enjoyed Mars Attacks, although I don't think it's a particularly good film, but I actually giggled all the way through it. You know, probably in some ways the most ambitious studio film of the year was The People versus Larry Flint, which has just come out. And it's making an attempt to actually grapple with something. But the problem with most of the studio movies is that it's hard to include them on a list of best films. You can enjoy them, but they seem to vanish from your skull almost the moment you leave the theater.
Are there any small movies you particularly liked that you think went unnoticed?
Yes, well, there are always lots of small movies that go unnoticed, and even worse, they often go unshown. You know, one of the very best movies I saw this year was a little Chinese movie by a woman named Ning Ying called On the Beat, which is a black comedy about cops in Beijing. And it's a really wonderful film that should have a distributor. It's probably one of my two or three favorite films this year. It played in Los Angeles, where I live, for one day. I think it played in New York for 2 days, both at film festivals. And it hasn't played anywhere else. And so what happens these days is that a lot of the good small films don't even get shown. You know, they're ignored even before the audience ignores them. They're ignored by distributors who don't think they'll make any money from them, and perhaps they wouldn't.
I imagine there are some films on your 10 best list that aren't going to make it to a lot of cities in America.
Yeah, I think that probably when I look at something like the Claude Chabrol film La Cérémonie, which is sort of a French Thelma and Louise kind of thriller, I think because it's in French, it may not make it to a lot of cities. The same is true of Chungking Express, that even though it had the power of Miramax behind it, it was a kind of half-hearted use of their power because there's a general sense that foreign films don't make money anymore. So theater owners don't want to have them in their theaters, and distributors are really reluctant to show them.
Any patterns that you saw this year in terms of subject matter, acting style, studios, whatever?
Well, I guess it seems harsh to say this. The major pattern is sort of an ongoing pattern of Hollywood sort of abandoning its desire to make good films as well as popular films. You know, traditionally, when you reached Christmas time, you always had kind of prestige projects by the major studios. But what's curious this year is that there are almost no prestige projects. I mean, something like The Crucible would be an example of one. And more the Hollywood is sort of internationalizing itself, going for the really huge blockbuster like a Jim Carrey film or Independence Day. There are still attempts at good films, but I think the major trend is that over the last 5 years that there's less and less attempt being made by Hollywood to make films that are somehow good just for the sake of being good. That seems like a sentimental notion, I think, at this point.
Now, how does that inferior quality of today's movies relate to the international market?
Well, I think that what's interesting is that, you know, around the world, people complain that American movies come in and devour their culture. You know, that people would rather see Independence Day than a little Italian or French film. And they're claiming that American culture is colonizing the world. Yet the great joke is that Hollywood movies themselves are being destroyed by the same colonization. Because increasingly, money can be made internationally. And so what happens is that films are being made that are a little bit less specific to America. They're a little less small. I guess the term for that is bigger. They're making films that are designed to appeal to everybody. And they lose some of their texture in an attempt to become international. So even as American culture is sort of dominating the world on one hand, American culture is slightly gutting itself by making films that are a little bit less American than they were before.
My impression, too, is that with the international market, there has to be less of an emphasis on dialogue, or at least subtleties within dialogue. So things are always kind of broader and more maybe about action than about speech.
Yes. Well, I think that speech is almost, you know, that Hollywood films that have a lot of talk don't play well internationally. Woody Allen's films have never been a huge hit internationally, and perhaps he's the talkiest of American directors right now. Whereas an Arnold Schwarzenegger film will play everywhere. People grasp it. They can follow the explosions. Jim Carrey films, because his comedy is so physical, they also play. So what you're finding is that the crudest and least subtle forms of American filmmaking are the ones that are the most surefire commercial hits internationally. And what that means when people are making films is that they're trying to make films that will play internationally as well as in America. So you have a sort of dumbing down and a cruding down of a lot of the films.
You know, part of my problem, too, as a moviegoer is not only are the major motion pictures not very good, but the theaters are falling apart. In the city of Philadelphia where I live, a lot of the movie theaters have closed down and are now drugstores, or they were just kind of, the buildings were eradicated altogether. And some of the theaters that do exist are, there's like one theater I used to go to a lot in my neighborhood, and it's a mess. It's filthy. They don't bother to clean it. It's crowded all the time, and they don't take care of it like you need to take care of something when it's really crowded. And the projection is bad. The sound is bad. It's just like drained all of the pleasure out of going to the movies.
Yes, well, I think one of the funny things is that, you know, technically certain things are better. So that, you know, one of the routine experiences of movie going these days is sitting in a theater and having this thing for maybe the Dolby sound system or the THX sound system doing this amazing stuff before the film.
Right, and exactly. Go ahead.
The fetish of the technology, of like how incredible the sound system is, and yet you look around you, the seat you're sitting in is too close to the next seat. It's made of a cheap and crummy plastic. The theater isn't kept clean. There's some sort of huge blotch on the screen, and that they haven't bothered to replace it. You can hear the movie from the next theater next door. I mean, it's so often when you go to these things, you are being told that you're getting the highest quality thing in the world, and yet you know you aren't.
John Powers is with us. He's Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue magazine. And we're looking back on 1996 and on related trends in the movie world. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic and film critic for Vogue magazine, John Powers. John, I know you grew up in Nebraska and Iowa. What were movie theaters like when you were in your formative years?
Well, I grew up in a town until I was 12 that was so small that it didn't even have a proper grocery store, let alone a movie theater. But we used to drive to the big city of Indianola, and I would go to see a kind of old-fashioned small-town movie theater, you know, with kind of the sticky floors and the screens that weren't properly paired and the kind of moth-eaten curtains. But it was very exciting. These were the theaters that would sometimes only be open for maybe one show on a weeknight, if any, and then open on Saturdays and Sundays. And then, you know, sometimes as a very special treat, we'd go to Des Moines for the new Walt Disney movie. I remember sobbing through Bambi and being traumatized for years and years. I mean, in fact, I think I'm kind of incredibly sentimental at movies, probably because of my Bambi experience.
How old were you when you were able to get to movies on your own?
I think, well, my family moved to Omaha when I was 12, and I was then able to take the bus or be taken by my parents. And, you know, that's when I sort of entered my corrupt, yes, crazed teenage sex years of going to see James Bond movies. I usually terrify the, you know, I've terrified probably all my girlfriends by saying that everything I knew about sex I learned from James Bond movies.
I used to go see all of those movies.
Yes. And I remember once, one of the great thrills of my life was I bought the first ticket to Goldfinger in Omaha. And then on the last day of its closing, I bought the last ticket to Goldfinger in Omaha.
A symbolic gesture, no doubt.
A symbolic gesture, yes. It's
so besides the James Bond movies, what were some of the movies that made the biggest impact on you?
Well, I think, you know, when I was younger, because I thought of myself as being brainy, I was kind of a sucker for kind of overly plush things like The Man for All Seasons or Lawrence of Arabia. So mm-hmm. I think I had, when I was younger, kind of square taste. And I think I was sort of shaken out of that a little bit by reading the film reviews and criticism of Pauline Kael, who sort of shamed me for thinking that I should have liked Ship of Fools. I remember, I remember seeing Ship of Fools and thinking, this is just rotten. But then probably telling people I thought it was great because everything I'd ever read told me I should think it was great.
And what did she say about it?
Oh, she thought it was rubbish. You know, I mean, you know, sententious, phony, badly acted. All the things that I'd felt, but somehow hadn't been legitimized in feeling.
So she gave you permission to trust those feelings.
Yes. You know, in the same kind of way that maybe a young person now who would go to see The Crucible would think, this isn't a very good movie. And yet there might be the kind of weight from their teachers and all the rest saying, this is a very important movie. And, you know, what Pauline Kael did for me was she gave me permission to say that what people think is important still might not be good.
Did the adults in your life try to protect you from certain films?
No, actually, my parents didn't really try to protect me from films. My father has absolutely no interest in films. I don't think in my lifetime he's ever sat through a movie. In contrast, my mother, growing up as a child, she and her brothers and sisters used to go off from 2 to 8 every Saturday and watch things over and over again. And so I spent my childhood watching films on television that my mother had dragged me to see. You know, she would say, oh, you've got to see this film. It's so great. So I grew up being extremely familiar with Bette Davis and Errol Flynn and Humphrey Bogart and Cary Grant, because those were the great touchstones of her younger life. And she passed them on to me. And so, you know, I feel actually lucky about that because, I mean, I now have this sort of sense of all these things.
Were there movies that spoke to you of another world? I don't mean in a science fiction sense, but in a sense outside of your hometown, there was a life and, God, maybe it was filled with sophistication or murder or things that were just beyond your experience.
Yes. Well, I think what's curious is that I think, probably like lots of young people, I was first drawn to thrillers and mystery kinds of things, partly because I think they're so extensively plotted and there's something in a teenage or adolescent mind that's drawn to the neat plotting of something. I mean, I think that's one reason why people like a film like The Usual Suspects so much, is there something kind of neat and beautifully orchestrated about it. So I remember I always wanted to live in a world where there were kind of dangerous bars and where there were glamorous women that you would get in trouble by getting involved with, and while where you were so mature and adult that you could actually walk into a foreign city and just simply order things and not have any problem. And I remember being a kid growing up in this small town of Martinsdale, Iowa, that has about 350 people, and, you know, thinking there must be something beyond this. I'd watch the train go by. It was near my house, and the train going out to the coast, and I'd watch it. And then, you know, when I'd see films, I would also think, you know, there's this big, wide world out there. And so I think movies were probably my real way of getting out. And, you know, I was probably more slow at doing this than lots of other people. You know, growing up in Omaha, I don't think I saw a foreign film until I went away to college because they simply didn't play in Omaha. And, you know, so that was a kind of new world for me, and it was originally scary and threatening. You know, I would see a film by Jean-Luc Godard, and I couldn't understand it. I just couldn't grasp how a film could be so different than what I knew a film was.
Was that what was threatening to you, the fact that you didn't get it?
The fact that I didn't get it. You know, why in this scene is the door constantly opening as people talk and you're hearing the traffic noise? And it wasn't until later that I grasped that the point of the scene was these people are talking over the traffic noise. You know, that American movies always kept the traffic noise out of the film. And Godard was putting the traffic noise in it. And I couldn't, for a long time, I just sort of thought, these are badly made films, or what's going on here? You know, why are all the people around me laughing and liking this? This is just terrible. This isn't like The Hustler. You know, this isn't like the films that I know. And then when I grew to understand them more, I grew to like them more. And then I was able to be sort of suckered into this entire world of international sophistication where you could, you know, join Marcello Mastroianni and, you know, and Anita Ekberg in The Fountain and all the rest.
Did you spend a lot of time in movie theaters while you were in college?
I did. I spent an incredible amount of time. I studied film in college, and I saw lots and lots and lots of films. I ran the Film Society, not very well, at Oberlin College, where I went to school. And so I saw an incredible number of films. And then when I was in graduate school at Stanford, there was an all-night movie show sponsored by a local car dealership. And I used to stay up all night almost every night and just watch all the films. I'd watch, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 a night.
That's great.
Yeah, I watch so much that I can still quote the ad for J. Brown's Spartan Dodge, 4590 Stevens Creek Boulevard in San Jose, where the Price Slasher lives.
As your memory is good for the movies that you saw. Do you remember the scenes? Do you remember dialogue?
I do remember some dialogue, although there are people who are much better at it than I am. I'm occasionally stunned when I meet certain friends and they will recall a small little moment from a film they saw 20 years before. And I often can't do that. On the other hand, certain things stick with me completely and absolutely. You know, there are, I can tell you probably every shake of the head and every bob of the hat that Rosalind Russell's wearing in His Girl Friday, which is probably one, maybe my favorite film. You know, it's just such an American film. I love it beyond measure. You know, it's funny, it's fast, it's got sexual banter. You know, it's slightly corrupt in its morality, which is a real Hollywood thing to do, to seem to be kind of serious but not really be serious.
And it's got journalism.
It's got journalism, yes. You know, but I like the kind of the racy big city feeling of it, and the people just firing wisecracks back so quickly that you can see the film three or four times and you'll actually hear lines you've never heard before.
John, I can't let you go without asking you to look ahead to 1997. Is there anything you're particularly looking forward to?
Well, I think the interesting thing about looking forward is that in the old days, you used to know what the big films were going to be. But increasingly, the films that are really exciting and fun are the films that actually seem to come from nowhere. I mean, I think last year at this time, no one would have thought that a film like Big Night would be a film that everybody's going to be talking about and have seen, or that Trainspotting would get as much buzz as it has. But these days, it's the sort of small films coming up from the margins that are really exciting. So in a way, I can't give you the answer of what these films are going to be, because they're going to be discovered. Whereas the films that you know about in advance, like the sequel to Jurassic Park, I'm not really very excited about that. But the things I don't know about, I am excited about.
Well, John, a real pleasure talking with you. I want to wish you a real happy new year.
Well, thank you.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, critic Ken Tucker reviews the year in pop music and plays us some of the recordings on his 1996 10 Best list.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this second half of our annual 10 Best Show, pop music critic Ken Tucker is with us to play some of the recordings on his 10 Best list. We're also going to talk about some of the year's developments in everything from gangster rap to country music. You may also know Ken from Entertainment Weekly, where he's critic at large. Let's get started with some music from his top 10 list. This is from Amy Rigby's CD, Diary of a Mod Housewife.
When we made our vows to have and hold, we never thought about how love grows old. Well, even healthy trees run out of sap. Baby, we're stronger than that. And when I look at you, I see too much. I try to walk away when things get rough. But every time I do, I come right back. 'Cause baby, we're stronger than that. We're stronger than the fairy tales, diaper pails, lack of heat, urge to cheat, shattered hopes, tired jokes, doctor bills, urge to kill. When we have another argument, you wonder where your feelings for me went. Well, even sugar peas run out of snap. Baby, we're stronger than that.
Ken Tucker, good to see you.
And nice to be seen. How are you?
Tell me why Amy Rigby is on your 10 Best list.
Well, I think Amy Rigby put out a really good example of a female singer-songwriter. This year there were a number of strong records in that category. But Amy Rigby's, I think, showing the influence of punk rock and how it's seeped its way into that kind of 70s singer-songwriter confessional mode, I think she's managed to combine this all. And, you know, she's an example of somebody who's like in her late 30s, still pursuing that rock and roll life. I think she's a very interesting performer at this point in her career.
What's been happening commercially in the rock industry this year? I've been reading about declining record sales. What does all that mean?
Yeah, the industry's gone flat. There's not been that kind of 20-25% growth that the industry has expected over the past decade. And a number of reasons are being put forward for this. Partly, they say it's because a lot of people have finally completed their transition from LPs to CDs, that people aren't buying CDs anymore, that especially baby boomers have now, you know, bought their copy of Moondance on CD, every single last one of them in America, and we don't have to have those sales anymore. They're also feeling competition from CD-ROMs and the internet. People are just spending more time doing other kinds of things, spending their money in different kind of areas. There's some feeling that bands are being brought out. It's almost like a return to the disco era of one-hit wonders. A band comes along, has one big hit. The record company just slaps out an album with the one-hit single and a lot of filler, puts a video on MTV, and then they're gone. They disappear. There's kind of no longevity among artists in a lot of cases. Also, it's just that the music isn't that good. It hasn't been that strong. I mean, these things do go in trends this way. And, it did strike me as I looked over the records I was compiling that there was a lot of good music here, but there wasn't any really great, there was no masterpiece in pop terms that I think that I heard this year.
Well, play something from your 10 Best list that seemed to break through in spite of the malaise in the record industry.
Yeah, I think this guy Beck, this whippersnapper Beck, who's got this album called Odelay, is really a wonderful guy in the sense that he's very eccentric. He's a white singer-songwriter who uses a lot of techniques of hip-hop collage in the way he produces it, the rhythms he uses. And I really like the way he puts things together in this kind of collage method that he uses. The cut we're going to hear is called Where It's At.
Thank you. habitations in the towns we know. A place we saw the lights turn low. The jigsaw jazz in the get fresh flow. Pulling out jobs and jamboree handouts. Two turntables and a microphone. Bottles and cans and just clap your hands or just clap your hands.
Where's that?
That's Beck from his album Odelay, one of the CDs on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list for 1996. Ken, how much did you find yourself listening this year to this kind of scavenger approach to music of, you know, borrowing from all sorts of other things and making it your own?
Yeah, I think that it's a real trend. I like the way Beck doesn't use that technique as a kind of some sort of ethnic exotic thing. You know, there are a number of white acts that do that. There's these bands Cake and 311 who've had hits. G Love and Special Sauce, a very mediocre band that's inexplicably a big favorite on the AAA format of radio that I resent the fact that they use it as if it's some sort of exotic technique they've just picked up. Beck really manages to work it into his style in a way that is much more kind of comfortable to what he's trying to get across, I think.
We were talking about the decline in record sales and this being a kind of lackluster year musically. Did any of the things on your top 10 list coincide with commercial success?
Yes, certainly. Sheryl Crow's album, it's her second album, which is called Sheryl Crow, I thought was a very strong record in a year that, I mean, even though I say that there's not any great works I heard, there were many strong records by women. Certainly the biggest commercial success continues to be in the past year Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. Sheryl Crow came back with a very strong second album. But I mean, as I look down my top 10, either women in groups like Fluffy, the English trio of women, even a country act like the Cox Family, which is led by two sisters, the Cardigans, a Swedish band with this female lead singer, the women's presence is very, very strong. One of the things I like particularly about the Sheryl Crow album is that it's one of those I Hate Being a Rock Star albums that artists often, that becomes their second, their sophomore effort is like they put out their first album, they become a big star, then they take their second album and whine about it. And the other two acts that did that this year were Tricky, this English trip-hop act who's very critically esteemed by everybody but me, and Counting Crows. They both put out records where they whine about how the burdens of fame. But I thought Sheryl Crow did it much more succinctly, much more kind of self-aware. And the cut I'd like to play of hers that's a good example of this, in fact, is called The Book.
Sheryl Crow, and that CD is on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list for 1996. Ken, you mentioned that this is a year when more women than usual have made it to your 10 Best list, and more women than usual have had a lot of commercial success in rock this year. Any reasons why you think that's happening now?
I think in general that people are just more willing to listen to women as that kind of voice of authority, that kind of voice of rebellion. The full range of women's experiences just seems to have made this breakthrough. I mean, people put down Alanis Morissette as being this kind of whiny, self-pitying. But, you know, I think that it sets the stage for a kind of range of emotions that don't often get heard widely. And I think that the more of that kind of thing that is heard, the better the music is.
There's a band of women that made it to your 10 best list.
Yes, Fluffy, this trio from England, who I think really, they work with the guy who produced, Bill Price, who produced both the Sex Pistols and the Clash. And to me, in the late 90s, this was like the perfect 1977 punk album. It's called Black Eye, the album. And they put on a great live show. They're really tough and aggressive, yet really smart and have a really good sense of humor. And to me, this was the hard rock album of the year, as far as I was concerned. The cut I'd like to play is called Too Famous.
That's Fluffy, and their CD Black Eye is on our rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best list. You know, it's funny. I think for a lot of people, the music they're nostalgic for is the music of high school or the music of college, and then it's kind of catch as catch can after that. And you were a rock critic in the 70s when punk was really catching on in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure that's a real, like, seminal period musically for you, even though college was behind you, high school long behind you.
That's right, yeah. And now I hear this new wave of bands coming along, and I think, ugh, that was done 15 years ago. You know, it's like I feel, oh, is this what being an old fogey is like? You say, oh, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, in Fluffy's voices, I hear Johnny Rotten. You know, it's that sneer that comes through. And it still seems very exhilarating to me.
Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker is with us, and we're talking about the year in pop music, and he's playing some of his choices for the 10 best of the year. Let's take a short break, Ken, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and we're looking at the year in pop music. Ken, there's usually one or two country music records on your 10 best list of the year. What's on it from country music this year?
Well, to me, country music really let me down this year. I mean, I usually go to country music to find kind of sustenance and energy and a different kind of voice than you get in mainstream rock and roll. And more this year, the country music I was listening to seemed very pale and derivative and just very tired, kind of exhausted. Lots of self-referential songs, you know, country singers singing country songs about country music and a kind of empty good time feeling. The biggest star in country music this past year has been Shania Twain, who's put out her debut album, sold millions and millions of copies, has outsold the previous superstar of the genre, Garth Brooks. And what she's done is works with her husband, producer Mutt Lange, who's best known for producing white hard rock acts like Foreigner. And she's come up with this pop country album that's perfectly decent. I think she has a nice voice and everything, but there's nothing adventurous about it. It's a very, very traditional record. The most interesting thing she's done is to kind of withhold herself from the public. She hasn't toured the way it's very standard in country music to get a hit single and go out and sell that record on the road and just keep out there on the road for, you know, 52 weeks out of the year. She has not done that. And sometime in the coming year, she's supposed to launch a tour, which by now it's so built in anticipation, it's going to be a tremendous event in country music and I think probably in pop music, which is part of the idea. So that's a smart thing. As far as artistry goes, the best country music I've heard all year comes not from any newcomer, but a grizzled old veteran, Willie Nelson, who put out an album called Spirit, which I think is really wonderful, very simply done. Very often it's just Willie and his acoustic guitar being strummed. It's almost like a folk record. I think it's got some really beautiful music on it, and it seemed to me to be the truest, most soulful country music. The cut I'd like to play is called We Don't Run.
We don't run, we don't compromise, we don't quit, we never do. We look for love, we find it in the eyes, the eyes of me and the eyes of you. You are the road, you are the only way. I'll follow you forevermore. We'll look for love, we'll find it in the eyes that see through all the doors. There is a train that races through the night on rails of steel that reach the soul, fueled by fire as soft as candlelight, but it warms the heart of a love grown cold. And we don't run.
That's Willie Nelson from his CD Spirit, which is on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list of 1996. Is it true that Willie Nelson still doesn't get played on country music stations?
That's true in the majority of cases. I mean, it's really amazing that the fact that those traditional, just by virtue of their generation and their instrumentation, those kinds of acts, he and Waylon Jennings, who's also done not bad work, don't get played on the radio.
I guess the biggest news story in pop music this year was the murder of Tupac Shakur. What do you know now about what the dispute was really about within hip-hop?
Well, there was this kind of East Coast versus West Coast rap faction, this kind of war which supposedly came to a head in the murder of Tupac Shakur, who himself was from the West Coast of this so-called gangster rap genre of rap music. I mean, I think already I hear comparisons to Malcolm X in the sense of here's a figure who was in the process of renouncing the violence that he had previously been espousing Tupac in his music, and just at the moment when he was having this change of heart, he's slain. I think that to a certain extent, you have to be a little bit cynical about what's been happening in the music itself, since gangster rap has kind of peaked commercially, and it may simply have been a wise commercial move for Tupac and people like him in this genre to kind of soften their message. On the other hand, I think that he was truly somebody who had a conscience, who was, in his own terms, his music was a series of documentaries, was a series of descriptions about what life was like, both his childhood and what he saw as an adult. I think that this coincided, interestingly enough, with a kind of revived creativity within the hip-hop community in terms of production. There's a group of loosely affiliated rappers and producers called the Wu-Tang Clan on the East Coast who have come up with this kind of production style, which I find absolutely fascinating. It's very thick, very dense. The beats kind of rise up from a murk and yet are also very catchy. Vocals are used less to sort of describe these street scenarios than as to just provide another noise on the soundtrack. I think that the work by those people is very, very interesting and bodes very well for the future. I certainly think that the clearest example and the most brightest star at the moment is this group called Blackstreet. Their song No Diggity just seems to me to be the perfect synthesis of rap and R&B this year.
Why don't we hear it?
Yeah. You know what? I like the place. No diggity, no doubt. Play on, play at. Play on, play at. Yo, Dre, drop the verse.
It's going down, fades to Black Street. The homies got at me, collab creations. Bump like agony, no doubt. I put it down, never slouch. As long as my credit can vouch, a dog couldn't catch me. Say, tell me who could stop with Dre making moves, attracting honeys like a magnet, giving them orgasms with my mellow accent. Still moving this flavor with the homies Black Street and Teddy, the original Rough Shakers.
Shutting it down, good lord. Baby got them open all over town. Strictly bitch, you don't play around. Cover much grounds, got game by the pound. Getting paid is a forte. Each and every day, true play away. I can't get her out of my mind.
Wow.
I think about the girl all the time.
Wow.
What I really wanted to mention was that those piano chords. That's like the instrumental hook of the year. I mean, I just love the way those deep piano chords come rising up in that. It's just a great sounding single. It's a really catchy song.
Yeah, it really is catchy. So that's somebody playing the piano as opposed to piano chords being sampled from somebody else's record?
Exactly. Yeah, a good move, I think.
So that's a single, not a CD. So it's kind
that's
of
right.
Semi on your 10 best list.
That's right. Yeah, right. If I was giving you a list of singles, that would be at the top.
Well, Ken Run will run through his complete 10 best list in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air's pop music critic, Ken Tucker. Well, is this the moment of truth when you actually run down your entire 10 best list?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
Here it is. No particular order. I think these are all very strong records. Beck's Odelay, Fluffy, Black Eye, the Sheryl Crow album, which is called Sheryl Crow, Amy Rigby's Diary of a Mod Housewife, Tony, another R&B group that's really melodic and kind of looking back to the 70s and yet applying their own 90s touches to this. Their new album was called House of Music. Willie Nelson's Spirit. The Cardigans, a Swedish band that I reviewed here a month or so ago, their album was called First Band on the Moon. The Cox Family, a traditional bluegrass outfit, a family that their album was produced by Alison Krauss. It's called Just When We're Thinking It's Over. Number 9, Loudon Wainwright III, Grown Man. That's my man, Loudon Wainwright. And number 10 is Sleater Kinney, another excellent women-led punk group from the Midwest called Call the Doctor is their album.
Okay. Ken, a couple of odds and end questions here. Were there any big disappointments for you this year? Albums you were looking forward to, you thought they'd be real good, and they were not?
I ended up being disappointed with George Clinton's album. I thought it could have been a stronger example of his work, especially given the amazingly good concert I saw Parliament Funkadelic give in Central Park over the 4th of July weekend. As it stands, the best thing about it was its title, which is The Awesome Power of a Fully Operational Mothership. That album should have been a masterpiece with a title like that, but it wasn't.
You write for Entertainment Weekly. Were there any records that were the subjects of big disputes?
Curiously enough, the Beck album, there was a lot of people saying that Beck was kind of, you know, it was a fraud, and other people saying, no, this is the honest guy. He's doing solid work. I think there was that kind of thing. And there's also kind of strong reaction to gangster rap that really, this is a very political interpretation of that work, and people, you know, tend to condemn that work very strongly. I tend to really try to listen to it as music as opposed to that kind of, you know, messages sent out to be acted upon kind of thing.
Did you find yourself going back to any music of the past that you want to catch up on in rock country or any other genre this year?
Well, there were a couple of really good reissues I might mention. There was a, as someone who doesn't listen to a lot of jazz, I really like this Sun Ra double CD called The Singles, which had his work in doo-wop and just really good soul music, really. And I was really struck by how good that work was. The other country music CD, which I thought was really good, was by Johnny Paycheck. It's called The Real Mr. Heartache. Johnny Paycheck is a guy, you know the single, Take This Job and Shove It, which really sells his work short. The Real Mr. Heartache has these truly heartbreaking ballads of a man going through a very rough time in his life.
What's your favorite way to listen to music?
Well, I tend to listen a lot. I travel on the train a lot and in the car, so there's that kind of traveling music that I like to. Otherwise, it's, I sort of hold up in my office. I like to just really concentrate on the music. I certainly find that I don't go to as many concerts as I used to, but I also don't miss it because I find that often the concert experience is just, it's loud, it's blary, it's noisy, it's annoying, and I have the usual complaints that lots of concert goers do. I find at this point listening to the music, just concentrating on it the same way I would just concentrate on a book or just concentrate on a movie is the way to approach that music.
Well, Ken, I want to wish you a really happy new year, and thank you for sharing your top 10 list with us today.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry.
And Ken Tucker is rock critic for Fresh Air and writes about popular culture and is critic at large at Entertainment Weekly.
Happy New Year.
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 Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year's to you.
Happy New Year's to you.
May your days be bright. May your troubles be light. Throughout this wonderful year.
Everybody.
Throughout this wonderful year.
To all.
We're listening to a track from the double CD Sun Ra, The Singles. It's one of the reissues Ken Tucker just talked about. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineers this week are Chris Fraley, Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, and Fred Snyder. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy new year.
Be bright.